Well, this morning we find ourselves in the Torah portion named Mishpatim. Mishpatim, which starts in Exodus chapter 21. Now, usually when people get to this part in the Torah where the stories start to kind of taper off and then you find commandments and laws, it's like, oh, brother, oh, I want to get back to the stories about floods and you know, and plagues and waters parting and miracles. But why all these commandments? This Torah portion, which is just a few chapters, contains 53 commandments, 53 laws. And yet something inside of us thinks, oh, boring. But I want you to think about it a little bit differently. Do you want to know God? If you do, then when God gives us commandments and laws, what he's doing, he's revealing who he is to us. He's saying, this is what's on my heart. This is what's on my mind. This is what I see as valuable. This is what I see as dangerous. He's actually going beneath the surface and letting us look right into his heart and mind. And his Torah, you must understand, is something that is spiritual and holy and good. Just as his heart and soul are spiritual, they're invisible. His Torah is invisible. It's something you really can't put into words. But what he does, he takes the things of the day. He's speaking to Middle Eastern Jewish people who basically have been slaves but are going to be entering into an agricultural kind of economy and way of life where it's always going to be fields and flocks and herds and houses, very basic earthy kinds of things. And so what he does, he expresses his Torah, his heart to them, in a way that applies to what they do every day. And we have to be very careful that as we read a commandment about an ox falling in a ditch, we don't say, well, that doesn't apply to me, I don't own an ox. And when it talks about digging a pit and the guidelines for when you do dig a pit, you say, that doesn't apply to me, I don't even own a shovel. And we can start going along just dismissing every commandment, commandment after commandment after commandment. It doesn't apply to me. And what you're doing, you're dismissing who God is. Because you see, every commandment has an outside. That's its physical application. But it has an inside to it, which applies to every area of our lives. There's not a single commandment inside these chapters. There's not a single one of these 53 commandments that does not apply to every single one of us here today. But what you have to do, what I have to do, is take that commandment and guard it. First of all, recognize this is a precious thing. Learn to peel it back and open it and see what is inside of it. And if you can do that, it's going to change your life. Now, here's just one example. It's the one that Paul gives us. I always feel a little self-conscious using this one because it sounds a little self-serving coming from me. But, you know, in Deuteronomy 25:4, there's a very simple commandment. It says, you shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain. All right? I don't own grain. I don't know an ox. I don't even know what a muzzle looks like. I don't have to apply that commandment to my life, right? But then later, Paul refers to this commandment in Deuteronomy, this little obscure commandment about when you have an ox and you've got it attached somehow to a grinding wheel and it's going in circles, grind out the grain. Don't put a muzzle over it. Let it eat while it's doing this. So in 1 Corinthians 9, verses 8 to 11, this is what Paul says. Do I say these things on human authority? Does not the Torah say the same? For it is written in the Torah of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain. Then he said, Paul asks a question, is it for oxen that God is concerned? In other words, is God so concerned about oxen that he gave his commandment? No. Of course he cares about every living thing. But he gives us the commandment because we can apply it to all kinds of situations. So Paul says, is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not speak entirely for our sake? That's the question you can ask about every single one of these commandments. Is God not speaking this commandment for our own sake? It was written for our sake, because the plowman should plow in hope, that the thresher thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. If we have sown spiritual things among you, Paul says, if we've been have worked to sow spiritual things among you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? And again, this sounds self-serving coming from me. But I want you to know that the Beth Tikkun doesn't take care of me. It spoils me rotten. Okay, so there's no message here, no subtle message to you that somehow this ox is being muzzled. I am not. I've been treated with nothing but generosity, much more than I deserve. But the principle is what I want you to see. An obscure commandment about an ox applies to us. Now, let's take a look at something that in this Torah portion that you could very easily just read right over and think, well, what in the world does that have to do with the price of beans in Poland? So let's look at chapter 22, verse 6. Let's start there. We're going to read the passage, 22, 6, to up through verse 14. 22, 6, we'll start there. If a man shall give money or vessels to his fellow to safeguard, and it is stolen from the house of the man, if the thief is found, he shall pay double. If the thief is not found, then the householder shall approach the court. The word there actually is the Elohim. The word Elohim is found a bunch of times in this Torah portion. And you have to look very carefully to see how it's used. It can apply to God. It can apply to judges. It can apply to different things. You have to look at context. He shall approach the court that he had not laid his hand upon his fellow's property. For every item of liability, whether an ox, a donkey, a sheep, or a garment, regarding any lost item, about which he says, this is it, to the court shall come both their claims. Whomever the court finds guilty shall pay double to his fellow. So, what we've just read about is what we would call an unpaid guardian. There's an owner of an object. And he gives it to someone else, says, would you watch this for me, please? Maybe he's going on a trip, whatever. Would you watch this till I get back? Now, in verse 9, we look at a paid guardian. An owner of an object says, would you watch this for me? And when I get back, I'll pay you for having taken care of it and guarding it for me. If it says in verse 9, if a man shall give his fellow a donkey or an ox or a sheep or any animal to safeguard, and it died or is broken or was looted without an eyewitness, an oath of Adonai shall be between them both that he did not lay his hand upon the property of his fellow. The owner shall accept it, and he shall not pay. So here's a case where the owner was going to pay the guardian. Something happened to the thing he was guarding. But was beyond the guardian's ability to protect. So the object is lost, but the owner does not have to pay the guardian. And then you go on down. Let's go to, we'll pick it up in verse 13. Verses of 13 and 14. Now this is a borrower. This is where someone owns an object and someone comes to the owner and says, may I borrow that, please? I need to dig a pit. May I borrow your shovel? All right? If a man shall borrow from his fellow, and it shall become broken or shall die, provided its owner is not with him, he shall surely make restitution. If its owner is with him, he shall not make restitution. Okay? So this is a borrower. Then we have a fourth category, the renter. Because the end of verse 14 says, if he was a renter, it came in return for his rental. Now, the first thing you do when you read this, you think, okay, you know, I've loaned objects to people and they've gotten damaged or lost. People have loaned things to me and certain things have happened. I need to learn how to apply this. That's very true. This is a very practical passage of Scripture when it comes to dealing with things between people who are owners and people who are borrowers, renters, or guardians. But is God so concerned with this area, this tiny little area of our lives, and he gives all this room to it? Is there something deeper here? You've got four situations here. In each situation, you have the owner who owns the object, and you have someone else who temporarily has possession of that object. You've got an unpaid guardian, and you've got a paid guardian. Then you've got someone who's come to the owner to borrow something temporarily to give it back. Then you've got a renter. May I use this for a certain time, amount of time, and I'll pay you for the time that I used it. The sages have looked at this and said that each of us is a guardian of some sort, and God is the owner of everything. Every one of us has an owner. God is the owner. He's the creator of all. He's the owner of all. He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. He owns you and me. He owns everything. But every one of us is either a guardian or a paid guardian or a borrower or a renter. And it describes four levels of relationship with God. Four levels of spirituality, if you want to call it that. Let's take a look at these. It's pretty fascinating when you take a look at it in this light. And I'm starting here with our portion just to whet your appetite, to try to get you to think and approach these commandments in a unique and different way. First of all, you have the unpaid guardian. This is the highest. This is what we should all aspire to be. This unpaid guardian is the man who feels that he was created only to serve God. The owner comes to the guardian and says, I have something very precious to me. I'm going to give it to you for a while. You watch it. You take care of it. When I return, I want it back. This unpaid guardian is the person who realizes that his body, his soul, his mind, his abilities, everything in his life does not belong to him. It belongs to the owner. It belongs to God. This man does not look for payment. This man's privilege is to be entrusted with these things so he can take care of them and return them to God, maybe in better condition than he received them, like the wise servants who takes what is loaned to him and invests it and makes it grow so when he has to give an account, there's even more of it, that he's used these things to bless the owner. So many times we don't tend to look at ourselves in this way. We tend to think that what God gives us, we own. But that is not the case. This man, he sees his life possessions as God's property, not his own, which is placed in his trust. He does not feel like God owes him anything. You know, we've talked before about, if you want a sure way to make yourself miserable, start telling yourself you deserve something. The moment you start thinking, I deserve, and then fill in the blank, I deserve better, I deserve to be happy, I deserve, the moment you start thinking that, and that's a thought the enemy puts in your mind, then the enemy's going to make sure you don't get what you think you deserve. It's like they say about Adam and Eve. It says Adam and Eve are perfectly happy in the garden until someone suggested they could be happier. And then they became miserable. Let's get something straight. You don't deserve anything. I don't either. So anything you've got in your life that's a blessing, thank God for it. Next you have, we're going to go to the borrower next. The borrower is the man who benefits from what he borrows. He goes to the owner, may I have such and such? May I borrow this from you? But the owner enjoys no benefit. The owner enjoys no benefit from it. He seeks self-fulfillment alone. He may acknowledge who the ultimate owner is, but feels he owes him nothing. You borrow it, you use it, you enjoy it, whatever. Okay, here it is back. Thanks a lot, but I owe you nothing for it. Are any of you like that? You give God his due. You realize you owe him everything. Do you realize that since we are not our own, we've been bought with a price? If we've been bought with a price, you need to give God what he has purchased. He's purchased you. You need to lay down your rights to yourself. That's what denying yourself is. You lay down your ownership rights to yourself. And you realize, I do not belong to me. I belong to a master, to an owner. The moment you start thinking you have ownership of your time, in your abilities, in your life, you're on the road to misery. And then you have the renter. This is the person who goes to God and to borrow, and then he wants to pay him back. Let's pay him back. The renter resembles the borrower, but nevertheless feels that he ought to earn the privilege by also serving his creator. Now, this is probably where most of you are, most of us, and this is where I find myself too many times. I realize God's the owner, and I'll serve him. I'll serve him just to pay him back. But is there any love involved in this? You're kind of turning it into let's make a deal. And then the last one is the paid guardian. The paid guardian is like the unpaid guardian, the first one, in that he sees the fulfillment of God's will as the ultimate purpose of life, but he reserves for himself a level of self-interest as he thinks he deserves some independence for his work. This may be the other one we find most common. Yeah, you know, there's the ultimate purpose is to serve God, but you know, there's a little bit I want to keep back for myself. God does owe me, after all. And so I expect to be paid for guarding what he's entrusted to me. I expect from him. I deserve something from him. The question is, which one is you? But the real question this morning is, can you see how these commandments are teaching us these things? Can you see how in each case the owner is God, but the borrower, the guardian, the renter is you and me? And there may be some things in your life where you're the unpaid guardian. There may be some other things in your life. I think sometimes we treat our kids with greater ownership than we do anything else. And we believe that we are the paid guardians when it comes to our kids. But we're the unpaid guardian when it comes to our talents. I don't know. This is something you can spend a lot of time meditating on, reflecting on, weighing and measuring. This is meat that you chew and you break down. You see, how does it apply to me? Where am I on this scale? By the way, one of the wonderful things in here that I don't want you to miss is the part here in verse 14. It says, if its owner is with him, let's back up to 13. If a man shall borrow from his fellow and it shall become broken or shall die. So I borrow, fill in the blank, I borrow something from you. Someone recently borrowed a book from me and they felt badly because it got some water damage. It was still fine, but they insisted on buying a new book, replacing that book with a new one. I've borrowed things and it breaks, and then you, oh, what do I do? You need to make it right. He says, if the owner is not with him, he shall surely make restitution. If someone loans you something, you're using it, and the owner is not with you, and it breaks, you have to replace it. Get it repaired, replace it. You have to make it right. But it says in verse 14, but if its owner is with him, the borrower, he shall not make restitution. Isn't that strange? The logical reason is if the owner is with the borrower at the time of the breakage, the owner is in a position to stop the breakage. Say, hey, well, don't do it that way. He could intervene. He could stop it. If the owner is with him, he shall not make restitution. One rabbi, I just love his insight on this. He says, I'm going to read it so I don't mess it up by trying to quote it. So since one's soul is borrowed from Hashem, he's the owner, we're the borrower, should he not be responsible for everything he does wrong, even through negligence or by accident? But Rabbi Yehuda Alter, who died in 1905, this is what he says. By connecting oneself to the Holy One with all of his soul, then the owner is with him, and everything's forgiven. Isn't that beautiful? Make sure that as you use this soul that you have borrowed from God, make sure He is with you all the time. So that when things go wrong, and they will, He forgives you because He's with you. He takes care of it. You follow that? But if He's not with you, you will make full restitution for what you've damaged. You see the depth and the richness in these commandments? You see how God is revealing His very heart and mind and soul, and these things that at first, boring. Ah, what does this have to do with me? You've got to grasp hold of this. Because if you neglect it, you're neglecting it to the harm of your own soul. So, let's back up a bit. You know, I'd love to spend time on these first commandments, the commandments about servants, or some translations put slaves there. But we've talked about this many times in past studies of this Torah portion, so I suggest you go back to 2010 when we last studied this portion, and you can listen to the teaching where we talked about the Jewish bondman and getting the ear pierced and with an awl to the door or the doorpost, how this is a picture of Messiah's sacrifice, how it's a picture of us giving ourselves to Him. Because we love being in service to Him so much, we can't imagine leaving His service. So, though we were into His service, first of all, because we were purchased or we were paying off a theft that we committed, when it comes time for our freedom, we say, I don't want to go free. I love my Master. I'm going to stay in your house and serve you forever. It's an amazing picture. But there are other things that I've discovered this week I want to share with you instead. So, let's go back to chapter 21 and pick it up in verse 28. We'll start chapter 21, verse 28. We're going to see four things here that are devourers, destroyers. Verse 28, if an ox shall gore a man or woman, and he shall die or she shall die, the ox shall surely be stoned. Now, you have to understand that stoning, when it uses that term, we picture just getting around throwing rocks at it. Take a lot of rocks to kill an ox, let me tell you. When they stoned someone, it was not quite that brutal. It was much quicker. They would take them to a cliff, a high cliff, where it was a rock at the bottom, push them off, so when they hit bottom, they were dead. Boom. It was instantaneous. And then they would throw some rocks on it so that where they landed became its grave as well. That's how stoning took place in ancient times, okay? So get this idea of just throwing rocks at it. That'd be more punishment for the rock throwers, I think, than for the ox. But it'd be an instantaneous death off a high cliff, and then they would just throw rocks down on top of it to bury it. Its flesh may not be eaten, and the owner of the ox shall be innocent. But if it was an ox that gores habitually from yesterday and the day before yesterday, and its owners had been warned but did not guard it, and it killed a man or woman, the ox shall be stoned, and even its owners shall die. This teaches you about responsibility. You say, I don't own an ox, I'm off the hook. Do you own a dog? Do you own a car? Do you have a teenager who drives a car? You get the idea? You're going to find personal responsibility is emphasized throughout the Torah. Personal rights or not. Because if people live up to their responsibilities, everyone's rights will be taken care of. But if everyone's looking up for their own rights, the society will devour itself. It will destroy itself. And what do we hear all the time today? Rights, 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 rights. But not one single word about responsibilities. But verse 30. So did they actually take the owner out and kill him? It says, when an atonement payment shall be assessed against him, he shall pay as a redemption for his life. See the mercy there? He deserves to die, but we'll let him make an atonement payment and redemption for his life. Whatever shall be assessed against him, whether it gores a boy or it gores a girl, in accordance with this judgment shall be done to him. If the ox shall gore a slave or a maidservant, 30 silver shekels shall he give to his master. Notice what the price of a slave was, 30 silver shekels. When Yeshua was sold, how much was he sold for? 30 silver shekels. the price of a slave. And then in verse 33, we move from an ox to a pit. If a man shall uncover a pit, or if a man shall dig a pit and not cover it, and an ox or a donkey fall into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He shall return money to its owner, and the carcass shall be his. And then it goes on in verse 35, going back to the ox a little bit. What if an ox, instead of goring a person, gores another ox? But we're going to move on. And move on down to chapter 22, verse 4. The third category of damages. If a man permits livestock to devour a field or vineyard, whether he set loose his livestock or he grazed it in another's field, from the best of his field and the best of his vineyard shall he pay. So you're responsible for your ox if it hurts someone. You're responsible for holes you dig or holes you uncovered if they hurt someone or something. You're responsible for your cattle if they should graze on someone else's crops. You have to make restitution. And then the fourth thing is in verse 5. If a fire shall go forth and find thorns, and a stack of grain or a standing crop or a field is consumed, the one who kindled the fire shall make restitution. Now, you might think that, okay, the cattle, the ox, and the pits, they don't apply to me. But fires, every once in a while, I start a fire. Listen, these all apply to you in deeper ways than you might imagine. Now, it may not be evident when you just look at this, but if you study this for a while, you'll see personal applications. They'll be pretty obvious, actually. But I want to show you something that reveals itself only in the Hebrew. Only in the Hebrew. And if I have not encouraged you lately to learn Hebrew, to whatever degree you can, let me encourage you again this morning. Hebrew is an extraterrestrial language. It is the language of transcendence. It is the language of angels. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, this is the tongue of angels. This is the heavenly tongue. It is the oldest. It is what preceded all other languages. And there is no other language that can express God's heart like Hebrew. Everything else is just a dim mirror. But Hebrew is a clear mirror. It's a clear glass that allows us, if we look into it, to see depths and shades and nuances of his words that do not reveal themselves in the other language. Most of you have heard the analogy one rabbi gave when he said that studying the scriptures by means of a translation is like kissing a woman through a veil. You get the analogy? Picture your wife with a veil and you give her a kiss without her taking the veil off. It's better than nothing, but not nearly as good as when the veil is out of the way. Translations are the veil between you and the lover of your soul. Hebrew allows you to remove the veil. So there's a more intimate contact with the Word of God. So here are the four deadly forces that the sages refer to these as. The ox. Ox is pronounced shor. There it is in Hebrew in its pronunciation. These are the verses that we read about the ox. There is the pit. Pit is bor. The eater. The mava. And that is the word that is used here. It doesn't specify any particular kind of animal, just the mava, the eater. And the fire, the hevir, and that is how it's pronounced. So what does that reveal to us? Each one of these four words, spelled exactly the way it's spelled here, but pronounced differently, becomes an entirely different word. For example, the word for ox, shor, can also be pronounced shur. Notice the letters are the same. Shin, vav, resh. Shin, vav, resh. The little dots are just the vowel sounds that were added on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later, so we would know how to pronounce the words. But if you take ox, shor, and pronounce it shur, it becomes to look. God is telling us something here. One of the deadly forces in your life is your eye. How did Adam and Eve fall into sin? Eve, first of all, saw that the fruit was good for food. And what is it John tells us that the three deadly forces are in that verse? The lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, part of life. Lust of the eye is the first thing. Faith comes through hearing. But I tell you, everything that destroys faith and pulls us away from God comes through the eye. And you talk to people, if you had to lose one of your five senses, what one would you hate to lose the most? It's always, without exception, I hate to lose my eyesight. Because something about us as fleshly creatures is our eyes that are the most important to us. But in God's economy, it's the ear. It's the ear. If you take the word for pit, the word boar, spell it the same, pronounce it boar, becomes an ignoramus. The sages say an ignoramus is one who fails to study the Torah. To not study the Torah is deadly in your life. I don't care if you love Jesus. If you're not studying the Torah and obeying it, you are sowing destruction in your life as a believer. One of the things the enemy has done among the Jewish people is to blind them to who Yeshua is. And he's been successful in that for the last 2,000 years. He's losing ground, though, in this generation. And the thing that the enemy has tried to blind Christians to, those who do embrace Yeshua, is to blind them to the fact that the Torah, every word of it, is valid today and applicable to our lives as believers in Yeshua. And he's been very successful the last 2,000 years of subtracting the Torah out of the life of Christians. But he's losing ground in this generation. Satan must be very frustrated these days. So to be ignorant of the Torah, it's deadly. Remember we looked a couple weeks ago at Amalek. When Amalek came and attacked the people of Israel, Moses would hold up his staff. It's a picture of the Torah. And when the staff was held up, it says Joshua got stronger. Do you want Yeshua strong in your life? Joshua and Yeshua, the same name. You want Yeshua strong in your life? Then lift up the Torah and obey it. It says, but when his arms got weak and he let his staff down, it doesn't say Joshua got weaker. It doesn't say that. When he let the staff down, it says Amalek got stronger. Do you want the flesh to be strong in your life? Do you want sinful desires and the forces of destruction to be strong in your life? Then be an ignoramus when it comes to the Torah. Skip over the commandments and just read the fun stories to your kids at bedtime. I'm sorry, that sounds like preaching, doesn't it? I'm not angry at you guys. You guys are all on board with this. The eater, the mava, pronounce it mave, and it's a glutton. It's not much of a change, but the eater, which is referring to some kind of cattle, it's the word for glutton. Gluttony. Taking more from this world than you really need. And then the fourth one, the fire, havir. Pronounce it haver, it's anger. Talk about a deadly and destructive force in your life, anger. Look at these four. You might be thinking, you read about oxen pits, cattle eating someone else's crops, and fire. But what God is saying, watch your eyes, don't be ignorant of my Torah, don't be a glutton, and avoid anger. It's like fire. Anger will spread and consume everything around you. You see that? Now again, this will reveal itself only through the Hebrew. And we haven't changed the words at all. We're just pronouncing them differently. You pronounce them differently, they're a different word. All right? I'm sure there are examples in English. I just can't think of any offhand. Should I leave that up a little bit? Are you copying those things down? This will all be on the internet sometime late tonight or tomorrow morning, so you can just print it out on your printer if you want. But there, I like the silence. Let's move on. Let's look at another one. I love this one. I shared this with Robin. I wasn't sure if I would use it in the teaching. She says, oh, you've got to use that one. So we're going to use that one. Because if I don't, well, we won't go there. But in chapter 22, verse 28, this is one of the most mistranslated verses I have ever come across. It says, Do not delay. Now, this is what the Art Scroll translation says. Do not delay your fullness offering or your priestly heave offering. We're just going to go that far. Now, in Hebrew, all that I just read is four words. There they are. Meleteka, Vedimeka, Lo Tacher. Now, the last two words, no problem. Lo means don't, and Tacher means delay. Do not delay. It's those first two words where the translators are all over the landscape trying to figure out what they mean. Let me read off a few translations. I just read the Art Scroll. Do not delay your fullness offering. So nowhere in the Bible do we find what's called a fullness offering. Or your priestly heave offering. No place in the Bible do we find that phrase used anywhere. There are heave offerings, wave offerings that the priest would wave, but a priestly heave offering or wave offering, not found in that phraseology anywhere in the Bible. The English Standard Version says, you shall not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest or from the outflow of your presses. Your outflow of your presses would be like your olive oil and your wine, your grape juice. The Complete Jewish Bible says you are not to delay offering from your harvest of grain, olive oil, or wine. Of course, the words olive oil and wine are not used anywhere in the verse. The Darby translation says you shall not delay the fullness of your threshing floor and the outflow of your wine press. And by the way, I'm saying verse 28. I think in your English translations is verse 29. This is one of those chapters where verses are off by one. The Jewish Publication Society translates, you shall not delay to offer of the fullness of your harvest, and now the outflow of your presses. King James says, you shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe fruits and of your liquors. Isn't that something? God doesn't want us to drink, he says, but give it to me. I mean, that doesn't make sense. New American Standard, you shall not delay the offering from your harvest and your vintage. Why is there so much confusion over these two words? It's because to translate them literally just simply didn't seem to make sense in the context. But to translate them literally, I think, makes all kinds of sense. You see, that first word comes from the word meleia, which means whole or fullness. And it's saying, don't delay to give God your fullness. That's pretty easy. It doesn't say your fullness of what. They're putting in all this about your harvest and this and that, but the word harvest is not found anywhere in that verse. It's the next word that really gives the translators fit. And the root of that next word is the word dema. The first, or the middle three letters, dalet, mem, ayin, spell the word dema. It's used three times in the Bible. It's used once here. And then it's used over in Jeremiah 13:17. It's used twice in that verse. And that's it. And the word dema means to weep. It means tears or weeping, water coming out of your eyes. So if you want to translate this, God is saying your fullness and your weeping or tears do not delay to bring to me. That's what he's saying. Simply put, that's what he's saying. Your fullness. You have something you're just thrilled with, you're excited about, some blessing, some goodness, some joy. Bring it to him. Don't delay. Don't put off. Go to him right away and thank him. Pour it out to him. Pour out your heart of praise and love to him. You have something that's breaking your heart? Don't put it off. Go straight to God. Straight to him. Don't delay. Bring your tears to me as well. And it's like it says in the New Testament, that we are to cast all our cares on him, for he cares for us. You know, over in Jeremiah, that verse where that word is used twice, Jeremiah 13:17 goes like this, but if you will not listen to it, my soul will sob in secret for such pride, and my eyes will bitterly weep. Now, the word hasn't been used yet. He's talking about sobbing and weeping, but those are different words. And then it says, and flow down, that's dema, with tears, that's dema as well. And it's one of those places where you take a verb and you repeat it. You say it two times in a row. And in other words, I'll weep with great weeping, or I'll tear with big tears. And I'll really, really, really cry, is what he's saying. Because the flock of Adonai has been taken captive. Well, think about how wise our God is. He inspires the prophet Moses when he writes this. He tells him, this is the way I want you to word it. Mleateka v'demecha, your fullness and your tears. Don't delay to bring to me. And God knew full well he would not have another prophet use that word dema until Jeremiah's day, many centuries later. And many centuries later, we see God's son, Israel, the people Israel. He refers to Israel as his son. And the people of Israel have been taken captive. And his eyes are flowing with tears. He's brokenhearted. Let's go back to our verse in Exodus 29 in your Bibles, 28 in mine. Do not delay your fullness or your tears. And then it says, the firstborn of your sons shall you present to me. See the connection to Jeremiah? God's son, Israel, he calls it a flock there in Jeremiah. It's been taken captive. And why is the son brought up, the firstborn son brought up in the context of fullness and tears? Well, think about any of you ladies who have given birth, and husbands, if you were anywhere around when your wife gave birth. There was a lot of tears, then there was a lot of fullness. Both are involved in bringing forth birth. All pain is birth pain. You've heard me say that many times, and it's true. All pain in your life is birth pain. Even the pain of dying is birth pain, because what comes after death? A life that never ends. I mean, just a whole new level of life that you can't even imagine. But all pain is birth pain. And then after the birth pains and the new life comes, there's this fullness and joy. And nothing sums it up better than the birth of a child. And so God says, bring your fullness to me, bring your tears to me, because it's all new life. It's all a promise of something wonderful and good around the corner. Okay? So when you're weeping, bring that to me. And then when you're rejoicing, bring that to me. Bring it all. Now, if that doesn't express God's heart in a very special and intimate way, I don't know what does. And isn't that more meaningful than bring your harvest and your liquor? I mean, come on. Oh, well. Let's go on over to chapter 23, verse 5. Chapter 23, verse 5. It says, if you see the donkey of someone you hate crouching under its burden, would you refrain from helping him? You shall help repeatedly with him. How many times have we seen an enemy suffer? We think, serves him right. There's a feeling of, yes, everything rhymes. You know, there's justice in the world. It's poetic. Finally. But God says, no. You see someone you hate. You see an enemy. And their donkey is crouching under its burden. You go and help them. Over and over and over again. But. God says, no, you do it. This is a commandment. You know why God wants us to do that? Because that's what he does. That's what he's done in every one of your lives and done in my life. I hope he's not keeping records. I'm afraid he is, but he's probably lost count. How many times I have acted like his enemy, my life crashes, and he comes right along to repeatedly help get me out of the ditch. Now, here's another wonderful thing. In Hebrew, the word for donkey, chamor, has two meanings. It means a donkey, a male donkey, but it also means matter, like stuff, matter, physical matter. Now, we read the verse with that in mind. It says, if you see the matter, the physical matter of someone you hate, crouching under its burden, would you refrain from helping him? You shall help him repeatedly. You shall help repeatedly with him. This is what one rabbi has said about this. And this is what I find so valuable about reading the commentary of such spiritual men. Now, not all the rabbis are spiritual. Some of them said some pretty moronic stuff. Some of them are just extremely legalistic, but there are those throughout the ages whose writings are translated into English for us to enjoy that just go right to the heart of a verse, and they just, the light just shines out of it. This is what he says. He's quoting the passage, if you see your enemy's donkey lying under its load, you would refrain from helping him. Because it's not necessarily in the form of a question. It can be translated, when you see your enemy's donkey lying under its load, you would refrain from helping him. But you must help him unload. Rabbi Chaim Miller, who's one of the more modern rabbis of his studies of the ancients, this is what he says. He explains that the enemy is our matter. What's the enemy of your soul? It's this stuff. It's the physical matter that makes up your body. It's Amalek. It's the stuff that always leads you astray. This is why it needs to die and be buried, and then when it's resurrected, it won't have any issues anymore. But right now, your enemy is your flesh. The spirit has strong desires for God, and these strong desires are contrary to the flesh. And that's why it says that the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit lusts against the flesh. There's a war going on in every one of us. It's like every one of us has a Jacob and an Esau, like Rachel. You know, she's pregnant with Jacob and Esau. I'm sorry, not Rachel, but Rebecca. Pregnant with Jacob and Esau. And these kids are wrestling inside of her womb. What's going on? She goes to the Lord, and he says, two nations are warring within you. And it says, but the older one, the one born first, who came out all red and hairy, he's a man of the field, he's a hunter, he liked to kill and eat and trap, you know. He says, he will serve the younger, Jacob, who's born pure, complete. He liked to dwell in tents. He was a student of his father. But the one born first would turn out serving the younger. And every one of us, what is born first in our lives is this, the flesh. It wants fed, it wants changed, it wants entertained, it wants left alone, it wants played with, it wants. It's a man of the field, it's a part of the world, it's made out of dust. But what rises up in us as we begin to grow spiritually, as we're born from above, is the spirit. It's an indoor man, that's what it says of Jacob. He dwelt in tents. It's not exposed on the outside, it's something that dwells in the secret places. And he gets stronger and stronger. Eventually, Esau came to serve Jacob. And Esau was blessed by Jacob, but he came to serve Jacob. And though they were parted, and God dealt with Jacob, didn't deal with Esau, he dealt with Jacob. Then when he put them back together, Jacob was in the lead. And his blessings flowed over into Esau, and they embraced, and they kissed one another. And so, the flesh is our enemy. And so the rabbi says that the enemy is our chamor, our matter, our material bodies, for our flesh hates our soul. You know that's true. Your flesh, probably for some of you while you're sitting here, you're thinking, boy, when services are over, I'm going to go shopping. I'm going to get some work done at home. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And then in your spirit saying, no. Remember the Sabbath day, guard it, keep it holy. 6 days you do your work, and the seventh day you rest. It's my day, you don't work on this, you don't desecrate this day. But the flesh says, oh, but I got to get this done. And then the war's on. I mean, I'm just taking that example because it's Shabbat, you know, and I'm hungry, and I'm, you know, a few minutes we're going to go eat. But in every area of your life, the war is between the higher part of you, the Jacob part, who's in the process of becoming Israel. Because the life of every person is the life of a Jacob, a heel, becoming an Israel, a prince of God. That's the story of every life. Esau stays Esau to the end. But there's the war between you. It's going on inside you, your spiritual womb. And so, your flesh hates your soul. Your flesh hates it when it can't have its own way. When it wants to stay in bed, but your spirit says, no, 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 we're going to get up. We're going to pray. We're going to study. We're going to get up extra early to spend time in God's Word and praying over this day. Or at nighttime, the body says, stay up, stay up, stay up. Let's watch TV. Let's play games. Let's do, 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 do. And the spirit says, no, go to bed so you can get up early. You know, soul, you ruin all my fun. And this goes on throughout our lives. It's just the way it is. And so back to our verse. We'll get through this. It says our material bodies, our flesh, hates our soul. It's the enemy. And thus our bodies lie under a burden of laziness and reluctance to arise and pursue obedience to God. But you must help him. You get it? You help him by you purifying the body and you train it to obey God. Your body wants to deaden your soul. Your soul wants to train your body to be God's servant. No wonder that Paul writes later on in 1 Corinthians 9:27, but I discipline my body. Now think about this. I discipline my body. Who's the I talking to his own body? The I is the soul. It's Paul's very self. I discipline my body and keep it under control. I keep it under my control. If I don't, it will control me. And it will just smother out my soul altogether if I let it. But I discipline my body and keep it under control. Remember Jacob and Esau? Did Jacob want to kill Esau? Mm-mm. Did Esau swear to kill Jacob? Yes, he did. The flesh wants to kill the soul. It's the enemy. And Paul goes on, I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after teaching others, I myself should be disqualified. It's an ongoing war. That war against Amalek is a war that takes place generation after generation after generation. It goes on and on and on. It's a constant battle. The question is, who's winning it? I suggest the one who wins is the one you feed. You feed your soul and spirit, it gets stronger. If you don't, you know, then Amalek gets stronger. You let the staff down, Amalek gets stronger. You need to feed your body. Well, feed your bodies, but you need to feed your soul and spirit. And I suggest, and I've told this to people before, here's a good rule of thumb. How much time do you spend feeding your body every day? Preparing the food, ordering food, waiting for the food, eating the food? Spend that much time feeding on spiritual food. And if you can't spend that much time eating spiritual food, then cut back on the physical. And if you're not spending any time on spiritual food, don't eat anything that day. Train your body who's boss. Teach it who's boss. The body dies. You go on. So don't let the body win out on this one. Tell you what, if you practice that, we'd either have a lot of hungry people or a bunch of spiritual giants, one or the other. I don't know which. Well, anyways, we can't actually end early, can we? Is that allowed? Nobody's asking any questions. I was prepared for people. Is that? Oh, you do have a question. Okay. I I've heard that many times. People are so heavenly minded, they're no earthly good. Yeah. The thing is, that's not true. That's a lie. People are no earthly good because they're not heavenly minded. Some of the people we call heavenly minded are just religiously minded, and they are no earthly good. But to be truly heavenly minded is to have the mind of Messiah in my mind. And if I do that, then I will be like him going about doing good. All right? But it has to come from the invisible to the visible, from the inside to the outside, from heaven to earth, the spiritual to the physical. And so the problem is people are not heavenly minded enough. Again, religious minded, not interested in. Heavenly minded, absolutely.
One cannot get
too heavenly. Oh, and there's no such thing. No, no such thing. This earth is what's temporary. We're going to spend eternity in the spiritual realm, in the heavenlies. We need to start getting heavenly minded now. We're commanded to. Yeah. And when we do that, we'll do all kinds of good on earth. Incredible amounts of good. But you think of somebody who's not heavenly minded at all, I'm trying to think of a polite word. I can think of words I shouldn't use. But they're a pestilence on the earth. Yeah, they're a pestilence. Adam.
I'm looking at that verse and it says he must raise it with him.
Yes.
Does that imply, like, you see the enemy's donkey is kind of there breaking on the burden? You can't walk over there and help it up. You have to get his permission and then help it.
Yes, you must raise it with him. The question is it with your enemy or is it with the donkey's help? It doesn't specify. And so it's God's allowing to merge the two, because the donkey, in our case, the chamor, is the enemy. But you don't take the burden off the donkey to do it. You raise them up. You raise them up together. And so what we do, through the power of our soul and spirit, the truth of God, our commitment to obey him, we get this body to comply with our will, with the will of God. We don't just leave it in the ditch, useless. That remember, the chamor, the donkey, is a servant. Your body is a servant. The moment it becomes a master, it's deadly and it's ugly. It makes a great servant, but it makes a terrible master. Does that make sense? There's a lot. That's a great question you're asking. There are so many, many good ones in here. Yeah. Yes, John. Yes, yes. Yeah, the fire is a picture. It can be a picture of gossip, yes, absolutely. And, you know, even though they refer to here the word in Hebrew for fire here is one that means anger. I've never seen gossip produce peace and joy. It always produces anger. Yeah, so they do go hand in hand. And, you know, it's in James refers to the tongue as like a fire that can start and just can't put it out. How do you make recompense for gossip, for misuse of the tongue? You can't. You can't. You can't go back and fix what you've said unless you meet the people you've said it to. But you can't, after it's gone past them, it's out of your hands. You can go to the people you said it to and correct it, but who have they then passed it on to? That's out of your control. Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot easier just to keep the mouth shut than try to put out the fire later. I'm speaking to me on that one. So, you know, in our Torah portion, I'm surprised somebody hasn't asked that question about don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. That's in here. That commandment is repeated. It's in the Torah three times. Therefore, the Jews believe that it means three different things. And so they say, well, don't eat a kid with its mother's milk, but then don't ever eat any meat with any dairy product. And in fact, you should have two sets of dishes, two kitchens, and so on, because if God says it three times, there must be three layers and three things we have to do. I came across this story. It's a conversation between God and Moses. And God tells Moses, Moses, in keeping kosher, never cook a calf in its mother's milk. It's cruel. Moses, Lord, you're saying we shouldn't eat meat, milk and meat together? God, I'm saying never cook a calf in its mother's milk. Moses, Lord, what you are saying is we should wait after eating meat to drink milk. God. Moses, listen. I am saying, don't cook a calf in its mother's milk. Moses, Lord, you mean we should keep separate dish sets for milk and for meat? God, Oy Moshe, my son, do whatever you want. So with that, we'll close in prayer. Oh, pardon me? Oh, you have a quick question, do you? Yes. Adam was made first.
Adam, what I mean is, he was given a wife.
Yeah.
He was given animals to make. He was to care for both, but there was a difference because Eve was his partner, and the animals were to be cared for.
Yeah.
And in today's society, if you find a man treats his mother good, mm-hmm. his wife good, and his animals good, each in their own
it doesn't say anything about getting permission from the owner. It says, you help him.
It's yeah. helping, right. But even if the owner isn't around, if you see the cow getting ready to go over the cliff, you should push the cow away from the cliff and then inform the owner. Would that be correct?
Yeah, you take preemptive action. We were talking last night, you know, in American law, if you see a child fall into a swimming pool and you do nothing to help save that child, you're not held liable. There's no law that says you have to help save a life. That's why somebody gets mugged in public and spectators stand around and watch a person get mugged and beat up and maybe even killed. They're not held accountable. But in Torah law and in Israel, if you see a child fall into a swimming pool and you don't do everything humanly possible to save that child, you are held liable. You have broken the law. If you see someone getting hurt in public and you don't do something to help that person, you are held accountable. And you can be convicted for not helping. So that's the difference between man-made law and God's law. We must preempt when we have an opportunity to. And that even includes self-defense. Because to allow yourself to be murdered is the same as standing by and letting someone else to be murdered. You're commanded to defend yourself the best you can. Now, there are times when martyrdom is in line. But if you must take a life to save your own, then you do so. Otherwise, it's the same as standing by and letting someone else's life be taken. Right? So there's nothing holy or spiritual about not defending yourself, defending those you love, commanded to. But that gets into a whole other thing. So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time together. Thank you for your word. Thank you for your Torah. For Lord, it is a lamp to our feet and a light to our path. So Father, I pray that we would repent of the times we've looked at your commandments and just thought, oh, ho-hum. Dear God, change our hearts. That we might realize when we look at the things you command, we're looking right into your heart, into your mind, into your ways, and we're learning about you, our Heavenly Father. So, Lord, I pray you give us eyes to see, as David himself prayed, Adonai, open my eyes, and I may behold wonders out of your Torah. For Lord, it is so full of wonders that are beyond this world. Help us to appreciate them more and more every day. We ask in Yeshua's name. Amen.